said Professor Playfair.
This sounds basic enough, but what do we mean by the style and manner of the original? What does it mean for a composition to read easily? What audience do we have in mind when we make these claims? These are the questions we will tackle this term, and such fascinating questions they are.
He clasped his hands together.
Allow me again to descend into theatrics by discussing our namesake, Babel. Yes, dear students, I can't quite escape the romanticism of this institution. Indulge me, please.
His tone conveyed no regret at all. Professor Playfair loved this dramatic mysticism, these monologues that must have been rehearsed and perfected over years of teaching. But no one complained. They loved it too.
It is often argued that the greatest tragedy of the Old Testament was not man's exile from the Garden of Eden, but the fall of the Tower of Babel. For Adam and Eve, though cast from grace, could still speak and comprehend the language of angels. But when men, in their hubris, decided to build a path to heaven, God confounded their understanding. He divided and confused them and scattered them about the face of the earth. What was lost at Babel was not merely human unity, but the original language. Something primordial and innate, perfectly understandable and lacking nothing in form or content. Biblical scholars call it the Adamic language. Some think it is Hebrew, some think it is a real but ancient language that has been lost to time. Some think it is a new artificial language that we ought to invent. Some think French fulfills this role. Some think English, once it's finished robbing and morphing, might.
Oh no, this one is easy, said Rami. It's Syriac.
Very funny, Mr. Mercer.
Robin did not know if Rami was indeed joking, but no one else made a comment.
Professor Playfair ploughed ahead. For me, however, it matters not what the Adamic language was, for it's clear we have lost any access to it. We will never speak the divine language. But by amassing all the world's languages under this roof, by collecting the full range of human expressions, or as near to it as we can get, we can try. We will never touch heaven from this mortal plane, but our confusion is not infinite. We can, through perfecting the arts of translation, achieve what humanity lost at Babel.
Professor Playfair sighed, moved by his own performance. Robin thought he saw actual tears form in the corners of his eyes.
Magic.
Professor Playfair pressed a hand against his chest.
What we are doing is magic. It won't always feel that way. Indeed, when you do tonight's exercise, it'll feel more like folding laundry than chasing the ephemeral. But never forget the audacity of what you are attempting. Never forget that you are defying a curse laid by God.
Robin raised his hand.
Do you mean, then, that our purpose here is to bring mankind closer together as well?
Professor Playfair cocked his head.
What do you mean by that?
I only...
Robin faltered. It sounded silly as he said it. A child's fancy, not a serious scholarly query. Letty and Victoire were frowning at him. Even Rami was wrinkling his nose. Robin tried again. He knew what he meant to ask, only he couldn't think of an elegant or subtle way to phrase it.
Well, since in the Bible, God split mankind apart, and I wonder if the purpose of translation then is to bring mankind back together. If we translate to, I don't know, bring about that paradise again on earth between nations.
Professor Playfair looked baffled by this, but quickly his features reassembled into a sprightly beam.
Well, of course. Such is the project of empire, and why, therefore, we translate at the pleasure of the crown.
Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays they had language tutorials, which, after Professor Playfair's lecture, felt like reassuring solid ground. They were required to take Latin together 3 times a week, regardless of regional speciality. Greek, at this stage, could be dropped for anyone not specializing in classics. Latin was taught by a woman named Professor Margaret Kraft, who could not have been more different from Professor Playfair. She rarely smiled. She delivered her lectures without feeling and by rote memory, never glancing once at her notes. Although she flipped through these as she spoke,
as if she'd long ago memorized her place on the page. She did not ask their names. She only ever referred to them with a pointed finger and a cold, abrupt, "You." She came off at first as utterly humorless, but when Rami read aloud one of Ovid's dryer injections,
"Fugia bat enim,"
for she was fleeing, after Jove begs Io not to flee, she burst out in a fit of girlish laughter that made her seem 20 years younger, indeed, like a schoolgirl who might have sat among them. Then the moment passed, and her mask resumed its place. Robin did not like her. Her lecturing voice had an awkward, unnatural rhythm, with unexpected pauses that made it hard to follow her line of argument. And the 2 hours they spent in her classroom seemed to drag for an eternity. Letty, however, seemed rapt. She gazed at Professor Kraft with shining admiration. When they filed out at the end of class, Robin hung by the door to wait as she collected her things so they could all walk to the buttery together. But she instead went up to Professor Kraft's desk. "Professor, I was wondering if I could speak with you for..." Professor Kraft rose.
"Class is over, Miss Price."
"I know, but I wanted to ask you for a moment, if you have spare time, I mean, just as a woman at Oxford, I mean, there aren't so many of us, and I hope to hear your advice."
Robin felt then he should stop listening, out of some vague sense of chivalry. But Professor Kraft's chilly voice cut through the air before he could reach the stairs.
"Babel hardly discriminates against women. It's simply that so few of our sex are interested in languages."
"But you're the only woman professor at Babel. And we all, that is, all the girls here, and I, we think that's quite admirable. So I wanted..."
"To know how it's done. Hard work and innate brilliance. You know that already."
"It's different for women, though, and surely you've experienced..."
"When I have relevant topics for discussion, I will bring them up in class, Miss Price. But class is over, and you're now infringing on my time."
Robin hastened around the corner and down the winding steps before Letty could see him. When she sat down with her plate in the buttery, he saw her eyes were a bit pink around the edges, but he pretended not to notice, and if Rami or Victoire did, they said nothing. On Wednesday afternoon, Robin had his solo tutorial in Chinese. He'd half expected to find Professor Lovell in the classroom, but his instructor turned out to be Professor Anand Chakravarti, a genial and understated man who spoke English with such a pitch-perfect Londoner's accent that he might have been raised in Kensington. Chinese class was a wholly different exercise from Latin. Professor Chakravarti didn't lecture at Robin or make him do recitations. He conducted his tutorial as a conversation. He asked questions. Robin tried his best to answer, and they both tried to make sense out of what he'd said. Professor Chakravarti began with questions so basic that Robin at first couldn't see how they were worth answering, until he picked apart their implications and realized they were far beyond his scope of understanding. What was a word? What was the smallest possible unit of meaning? And why was that different from a word? Was a word different from a character? In what ways was Chinese speech different from Chinese writing? It was an odd exercise to analyze and dismantle a language he thought he knew like the back of his hand, to learn to classify words by ideogram or pictogram, and to memorize an entire vocabulary of new terms, most having to do with morphology or orthography. It was like tunneling into the crevices of his own mind, peeling things apart to see how they worked, and it both intrigued and unsettled him. Then came the harder questions. Which Chinese words could be traced back to recognizable pictures? Which couldn't? Why was the character for woman also the radical used in the character for slavery? In the character for good? "I don't know," Robin admitted. "Why is it? Are slavery and goodness both innately feminine?" Professor Chakravarti shrugged. "I don't know either." "These are questions Richard and I are still trying to answer. We're far from a satisfactory edition of the Chinese grammatica, you see. When I was studying Chinese, I had no good Chinese-English resources. I had to make do with
Abel Rimsa's
Éléments de la grammaire chinoise and Fouromont's Grammatica Sinica.
Can you imagine? I still associate both Chinese and French with a headache. But I think we've made progress today, actually. Then Robin realized what his place here was. He was not simply a student, but a colleague. A rare native speaker capable of expanding the bounds of Babel's scant existing knowledge. Or a silver mine to be plundered, said Griffin's voice, though he pushed the thought away. The truth was, it felt exciting to contribute to the Grammaticus, but he still had much to learn. The second half of their tutorial was spent on readings in classical Chinese, which Robin had dabbled in at Professor Lovell's home, but had never tackled in a systematic manner. Classical Chinese was to vernacular Mandarin what Latin was to English. One could guess at the gist of a phrase, but the rules of grammar were unintuitive and impossible to grasp without rigorous reading practice. Punctuation was a guessing game. Nouns could be verbs when they felt like it. Often, characters had different and contradictory meanings, either of which produced valid possible interpretations. The character duo, for instance, could mean both to restrict and large, substantial. That afternoon, they tackled the Xijing, the Book of Songs, which was written in a discursive context so far removed from contemporary China that even readers of the Han period would have considered it written in a foreign language. I propose we break here, Professor Chakravarti said after 20 minutes of debating the character Bu, which in most contexts meant a negative no, not, but in the given context seemed instead like a word of praise, which didn't track with anything they knew about the word. I suspect we'll have to leave this as an open question. But I don't understand, Robin said, frustrated. How can we just not know? Could we ask someone about all this? Can we go on a research trip to Peking? We could, said Professor Chakravarti. But it makes things a bit hard when the Qing Emperor has decreed it punishable by death to teach a foreigner Chinese, you see. He patted Robin's shoulder. We make do with what we have. You're the next best thing. Isn't there anyone else here who speaks Chinese? Robin asked. Am I the only student? A strange look came over Professor Chakravarti's face then. Robin was not supposed to know about Griffin, he realized. Probably Professor Lovell had sworn the rest of the faculty to secrecy. Probably, according to the official record, Griffin did not exist. Still, he couldn't help but press. I heard there was another student a few years before me, also from the coast. Oh, yes, I suppose there was. Professor Chakravarti's fingers drummed anxiously against the desk. A nice boy, though not quite as diligent as you are, Griffin Harley. Was? What happened to him? Well, it's a sad story, really. He passed away just before his fourth year. Professor Chakravarti scratched his temple. He fell ill on an overseas research trip and didn't make it home. It happens all the time.
It does?
Yes, there's always a certain risk entailed in the profession. There's so much travel, you know, you expect attrition.
But I still don't understand, said Robin. Surely there's any number of Chinese students who would love to study in England.
Professor Chakravarti's fingers quickened against the wood. Well, yes, but first there's the matter of national loyalties. It's no good recruiting scholars who might run home to the Qing government at any moment, you know. Second, Richard is of the opinion that, well, one requires a certain upbringing.
Like mine.
Like yours. Otherwise, Richard thinks...
Professor Chakravarti was using this construction quite a lot, Robin noticed.
That the Chinese tend towards certain natural inclinations, which is to say he doesn't think Chinese students would acclimatize well here.
Lowly, uncivilized stock.
I see.
But that doesn't mean you, Professor Chakravarti said quickly. You're raised properly and all that, wonderfully diligent. I don't expect that will be a problem.
Yes.
Robin swallowed. His throat felt very tight.
I've been very lucky.
On the second Saturday after his arrival to Oxford, Robin made his way north for dinner with his guardian. Professor Lovell's Oxford residence was only a shade more humble than his Hampstead estate. It was a bit smaller and enjoyed a mere front and back garden instead of an expansive green.
but it was still more than someone on a professor's salary should have been able to afford. Trees bearing plump red cherries lined the hedges by the front door, though cherries could hardly still be in season at the turn of autumn. Robin suspected that if he bent down to check the grass by their roots, he would find silver bars in the soil.
"Dear boy!"
He'd scarce rung the bell when Mrs. Piper was upon him, brushing leaves from his jacket and turning him in circles to examine his reedy frame.
"My heavens, you're so thin already."
"The food's horrible," he said, a great big smile spread over his face. He hadn't realized how much he'd missed her. "Just like you said, dinner yesterday was salt herrings," she gasped.
"No."
"Cold beef?"
"No."
"And stale bread?"
"Inhumane."
"Don't you worry. I've cooked enough to make up for it." She patted his cheeks. "How's college life besides? How'd you like wearing those floppy black gowns? Have you made any friends?" Robin was about to answer when Professor Lovell came down the stairs.
"Hello, Robin," he said. "Come in. Mrs. Piper, his coat."
Robin shrugged it off and handed it to Mrs. Piper, who examined the ink-stained cuffs with disapproval.
"How goes the term?"
"Challenging, just as you warned." Robin felt older as he spoke, his voice somehow deeper. He'd left home only a week ago, but he felt like he'd aged years and could present himself now as a young man and not a boy.
"But challenging in a way that's enjoyable. I'm learning quite a lot." "Professor Jacravarti says you've made some good contributions to the Grammatica."
"Not as much as I'd like," said Robin. "There are particles in classical Chinese that I've just no idea what to do with. Half of the time, our translations feel like guesswork."
"I've felt that way for decades."
Professor Lovell gestured towards the dining room.
"Shall we?"
They might as well have been back in Hampstead. The long table was arranged precisely the same way Robin was used to, with him and Professor Lovell sitting at opposite ends and a painting to Robin's right, which this time depicted the Thames rather than Oxford's Broad Street. Mrs. Piper poured their wine and, with a wink at Robin, disappeared back into the kitchen. Professor Lovell raised his glass to him, then drank.
"You're taking theory with Jerome and Latin with Margaret, correct?"
"Right. It's fairly good going." Robin took a sip of wine. "Though Professor Kraft lectures like she wouldn't notice if she was speaking to an empty room, and Professor Playfair seems to have missed a calling for the stage." Professor Lovell chuckled. Robin smiled, despite himself. He had never been able to make his guardian laugh before.
"Did he give you his Semeticus speech?"
"He did," said Robin. "Did all that really happen?"
"Who knows?
Except that Herodotus
tells us so," said Professor Lovell.
"There's another good Herodotus story. Again, about Semeticus. Semeticus wanted to determine which language was the foundation of all earthly languages, so he gave two newborn infants to a shepherd with the instructions that they should not be allowed to hear human speech. For a while, all they did was babble, as infants do. Then one day, one of the infants stretched out his little hands to the shepherd and exclaimed, 'Bekos,'
which is the Phrygian word for bread.
And so Semeticus decided the Phrygians must have been the first race on Earth.
And Phrygian the first language.
Pretty story, isn't it?" "I'm assuming no one accepts that argument," said Robin.
"Heavens, no."
"But could that really work?" asked Robin. "Could we actually learn anything from what infants utter?"
"Not that I'm aware of," said Professor Lovell.
"The issue is, it's impossible to isolate infants from an environment with language if you want them to develop as infants should. Might be interesting to buy a child and see, but, well, no." Professor Lovell tilted his head. "It's fun to entertain the possibility of an original language, though." "Professor Playfair mentioned something similar," said Robin, "about a perfect, innate, and unadulterated language.
The Adamic language."
He felt more confident talking to the professor now that he'd spent some time at Babel. They were on more of an equal footing. They could communicate as colleagues. Dinner felt less like an interrogation and more like a casual conversation between two scholars in the same fascinating field.
"The Adamic language," Professor Lovell made a face. "I don't know why he fills your minds with that stuff.
It's a pretty metaphor, certainly. But every few years, we get an undergraduate who's determined to discover the Adamic language in Proto-Indo-European, or otherwise wholly invented on his own. And it always takes either a stern talking to or a few weeks of failure for him to come back to his senses.
You don't think that an original language exists?
Robin asked.
Of course I don't.
The most devout Christians think it does. But you'd think if the holy word was so innate and unambiguous, there'd be less debate about its contents. He shook his head.
There are those who think that the Adamic language might be English, might become English, purely because the English language has enough military might and power behind it to credibly crowd out competitors.
But then we must also remember that it was barely a century ago that Voltaire declared that French was the universal language. That was, of course, before Waterloo. Webb and Leibniz once speculated that Chinese might, in fact, have once been universally intelligible due to its ideogrammatic nature, but Percy debunks this by arguing Chinese is a derivative of Egyptian hieroglyphs. My point being, these things are contingent. Dominant languages might keep a little staying power even after their armies decline. Portuguese, for instance, has far outstayed its welcome. But they always fade from relevance eventually. But I do think there is a pure realm of meaning, a language in between where all concepts are perfectly expressed, which we have not been able to approximate. There is a sense, a feeling of when we have got it right.
Like Voltaire, Robin said, emboldened by his wine and rather excited that he could remember the relevant quote. Like what he writes in his preface to his translation of Shakespeare. I have tried to soar with the author where he soars.
Quite right, said Professor Lovell.
But how does Frere put it? The language of translation ought, we think, as far as possible, to be a pure, impalpable and invisible element. The medium of thought and feeling and nothing more. But what do we know of thought and feeling except as expressed through language?
Is that what powers the silver bars?
Robin asked. This conversation was starting to get away from him. He sensed a depth to Professor Lovell's theorizing into which he wasn't prepared to follow, and he needed to bring things back to the material before he got lost.
Do they work by capturing that pure meaning, whatever gets lost when we invoke it through crude approximations?
Professor Lovell nodded.
It is as close to a theoretical explanation as we can get. But I also think that as languages evolve, as their speakers become more worldly and sophisticated, as they gorge on other concepts and swell and morph to encompass more over time, we approach something close to that language. There's less room for misunderstanding. And we've only begun to work out what that means for silver working.
I suppose that means the Romanticists might eventually run out of things to say, said Robin. He was only joking, but Professor Lovell nodded vigorously at this.
You're quite right. French, Italian, and Spanish dominate the faculty, but their new contributions to the silver working ledgers dwindle by the year. There's simply too much communication across the continent, too many loan words. Connotations change and converge as French and Spanish grow closer to English and vice versa. Decades from now, the silver bars we use from Romance languages might no longer have any effect. No, if we want to innovate, then we must look to the East. We need languages that aren't spoken in Europe.
That's why you specialize in Chinese, said Robin.
Precisely, Professor Lovell nodded. China, I am quite sure, is the future. And that's why you and Professor Chakravarti have been trying to diversify the cohorts.
Who's been gossiping to you about departmental politics?
Professor Lovell chuckled.
Yes, there are hurt feelings this year because we only took one classicist and a woman at that. But that's how it has to be. The cohort above you are going to have a tough time finding jobs.
If we're talking about the spread of language, I wanted to ask...
Robin cleared his throat.
Where do all those bars go? I mean, who buys them?
Professor Lovell gave him a curious look. To those who can afford them, of course.
But Britain is the only place where I've ever seen silver bars in wide use, said Robin.
They're not nearly so popular in Canton, or I've heard in Calcutta, and it strikes me, I don't know, it seems a bit strange that the British are the only ones who get to use them when the Chinese and Indians are contributing the crucial components of their functioning.
Well, that's simple economics, said Professor Lovell. It takes a great deal of cash to purchase what we create. The British happen to be able to afford it. We have deals with Chinese and Indian merchants too, but they're often less able to pay the export fees.
But we have silver bars in charities and hospitals and orphanages here, said Robin. We have bars that can help people who need them most. None of that exists anywhere else in the world. He was playing a dangerous game, he knew, but he had to seek clarity. He could not construct Professor Lovell and all his colleagues as the enemy in his mind, could not wholly buy into Griffin's damning assessment of Babel without some confirmation.
Well, we can't expend energy researching any frivolous application, Professor Lovell scoffed.
Robin tried a different line of argument. It's just that, well, it only seems fair there ought to be some kind of exchange.
He was regretting now that he'd drunk so much. He felt loose, vulnerable, too passionate for what should have been an intellectual discussion.
We take their languages, their ways of seeing and describing the world. We ought to give them something in return.
But language, said Professor Lovell, is not like a commercial good, like tea or silks to be bought and paid for. Language is an infinite resource. And if we learn it, if we use it,
who are we stealing from? There was some logic in this, but the conclusion still made Robin uncomfortable. Surely things were not so simple. Surely this still masked some unfair coercion or exploitation. But he could not formulate an objection, could not figure out where the fault in the argument lay.
The Qing Emperor has one of the largest silver reserves in the world, said Professor Lovell. He has plenty of scholars. He even has linguists who understand English.
So why doesn't he fill his court with silver bars?
Why is it that the Chinese, rich as their language is, have no grammars of their own?
It could be they don't have the resources to get started, said Robin.
Then why should we just hand them to them?
But that's not the point. The point is that they need it. So why doesn't Babel send scholars abroad on exchange programs? Why don't we teach them how it's done?
Could be that all nations hoard their most precious resources.
Or that you're hoarding knowledge that should be freely shared, said Robin. Because if language is free, if knowledge is free, then why are all the grammaticas under lock and key in the tower? Why don't we ever host foreign scholars, or send scholars to help open translation centres elsewhere in the world?
Because as the Royal Institute of Translation, we serve the interests of the crown. That seems fundamentally unjust.
Is that what you believe?
A cold edge crept into Professor Lovell's voice.
Robin Swift, do you think what we do here is fundamentally unjust?
I only want to know, said Robin, why silver could not save my mother.
There was a brief silence.
Well, I'm sorry about your mother.
Professor Lovell picked up his knife and began cutting into his steak. He seemed flustered, discomfited.
But the Asiatic cholera was a product of Canton's poor public hygiene, not the unequal distribution of bars. And anyhow, there's no silver match pair that can bring back the dead.
What excuse is that?
Robin set down his glass. He was properly drunk now, and that made him combative.
You have the bars. They're easy to make. You told me so yourself. So why,
for God's sake, snapped Professor Lovell. She was only just a woman.
The doorbell rang. Robin flinched. His fork clattered against his plate and fell to the floor. He scooped it up, deeply embarrassed. Mrs. Piper's voice carried down the hall.
Oh, what a surprise. They're having dinner now. I'll bring you in.
And then a blonde, handsome, and elegantly dressed gentleman strode into the dining room, bearing a stack of books in his hand.
Sterling,
Professor Lovell set down his knife and stood to greet the stranger.
I thought you were coming in late.
Finished up in London earlier than expected.
Sterling's eyes caught Robin's, and the whole of him went rigid.
Oh, hello.
Hello,
Robin said, flustered and shy. This was the famous Sterling Jones, he realized. William Jones's nephew, the star of the faculty.
It's nice to meet you.
Sterling said nothing, only perused him for a long moment, his mouth twisted oddly, though Robin could not read the attendant expression.
My goodness.
Professor Lovell cleared his throat.
Sterling?
Sterling's eyes lingered on Robin's face for another moment, and then he looked away.
Welcome anyhow.
He said this like an afterthought. He had already turned his back on Robin, and the words sounded forced and awkward. He set the books on the table.
You are right, Dick. It's precisely the Ritchie dictionaries that are the key. We've been missing what happens when we go through Portuguese. That I can help with. Now, I think if we daisy-chain the characters I've marked here and here...
Professor Lovell was flipping through the pages.
This is waterlogged. I hope you didn't pay him in full.
I paid nothing, Dick. Do you think me a fool?
Well, after Macau.
They fell into a heated discussion. Robin was entirely forgotten. He looked on, feeling tipsy and out of place. His cheeks burned. He had not finished his food, but it seemed very awkward to keep eating now. He had no appetite besides. His earlier confidence vanished. He felt again like a stupid little boy, laughed away and dismissed by those crow-like visitors in Professor Lovell's sitting room. And he wondered at the contradiction that he despised them, that he knew they could be up to no good, and that still he wanted to be respected by them enough to be included in their ranks. It was a very strange mix of emotions. He hadn't the faintest idea how to sort through them. But we haven't finished, he wanted to tell his father. We were discussing my mother. He felt his chest constrict, as if his heart were a caged beast straining to burst out. That was curious. This dismissal was nothing he hadn't experienced before. Professor Lovell had never acknowledged Robin's feelings, or offered care or comfort, only abruptly changed the subject, only thrown up a cold, indifferent wall, only minimized Robin's hurts so that it seemed frivolous to bring them up at all. Robin had grown used to it by now. Only now, perhaps because of the wine, or perhaps it had all been building up for so long that things were past the tipping point, he felt he wanted to scream, cry, kick the wall, anything, if only to make his father look him in the face.
Robin, Professor Lovell glanced up, tell Miss Piper we'd like some coffees before you go, will you?
Robin grabbed his coat and left the room. He did not turn from High Street onto Magpie Lane. Instead, he went further and passed into the grounds of Merton College. At night, the gardens were twisted and eerie. Black branches reached like fingers from behind a bolted iron gate. Robin fiddled uselessly with the lock, then hauled himself, panting over a narrow gap between the spikes. He wandered a few feet into the garden before realizing he did not know what a birch looked like. He stepped back and glanced around, feeling rather foolish. Then a patch of white caught his eye. A pale tree, surrounded by a cluster of mulberry bushes, trimmed to curl slightly upwards as if in adulation. A knob protruded from the white tree's trunk. In the moonlight, it looked like a bald head, a crystal ball. As good a guess as any, Robin thought. He thought of his brother in his flapping raven's cloak, brushing his fingers over this pale wood by moonlight. Griffin did love his theatrics. He wondered at the hot coil in his chest. The long, sobering walk had not dimmed his anger. He still felt ready to scream. Had dinner with his father infuriated him so. Was this the righteous indignation that Griffin spoke of? But what he felt was not as simple as revolutionary flame. What he felt in his heart was not conviction so much as doubt, resentment, and a deep confusion. He hated this place. He loved it. He resented how it treated him. He still wanted to be a part of it, because it felt so good to be part of it, to speak to its professors as an intellectual equal, to be in on the great game. One nasty thought crept into his mind.
It's because you're a wounded little boy, and you wish they had paid you more attention.
But he pushed this away. Surely he could not be so petty. Surely he was not merely lashing out at his father because he felt dismissed. He had seen and heard enough. He knew what Babel was at its roots, and he knew enough to trust his gut. He ran his finger over the wood. His nails would not do. A knife would have been ideal, but he'd never carried one. At last, he pulled a fountain pen from his pocket and pressed the tip into the knob. the wood gave purchase. He scratched hard several times to make the cross visible. His fingers ached, and the nib was irreversibly ruined. But at last, he left his mark. Chapter 7. Quod linguas quiscale, tot homines vale. The more languages you speak, the more men you're worth. Charles V. The following Monday, Robin returned to his room after class to find a slip of paper wedged under his windowsill. He snatched it up, heart hammering. He shut his door and sat down on the floor, squinting at Griffin's cramped handwriting. The note was in Chinese. Robin read it twice, then backwards, then forwards again, perplexed. Griffin seemed to have strung together characters utterly at random, and the sentences did not make sense. No, they could not even be described as sentences, for although there was punctuation, the characters were arranged without care for grammar or syntax. This was a cipher, surely, but Griffin had not given Robin a key. And Robin could think of no literary allusions or subtle hints Griffin might have dropped to help him decode this nonsense. At last he realized he was going about it all wrong. This was not Chinese. Griffin had merely used Chinese characters to convey words in a language Robin suspected was English. He ripped a sheet of paper from his diary, placed it next to Griffin's note, and wrote out the romanization of each character. Some of the words took guesswork, since romanized Chinese words had very different spelling patterns to English words. But in the end, through working out several common change patterns, te always meant the, u was u. Robin broke the code. The next rainy night, open the door at precisely midnight, wait inside the foyer, then walk back out at 5 past. Speak to no one. Go straight home after. Do not deviate from my instructions. Memorize, then burn. Curt, direct, and minimally informative, just like Griffin. It rained constantly at Oxford. The next rainy night could be tomorrow. Robin read the note again and again until he'd committed the details to memory, then tossed both the original and his decryption into the fireplace, watching intently until every scrap has shriveled to ash. On Wednesday, it poured. It had been misty all afternoon, and Robin had watched the darkening sky with accumulating dread. When he left Professor Chakravarti's office at 6, a soft drizzle was slowly turning the pavement grey. By the time he reached Magpie Lane, the rain had thickened to a steady patter. He locked himself in his room, put his assigned Latin readings on his desk, and tried to at least stare at them until the hour came. By 11:30, the rain had announced its permanence. It was the kind of rain that sounded cold. Even in the absence of vicious winds, snow, or hail, the very pattering against cobblestones felt like cubes of ice hammering against one's skin. Robin saw now the reasoning behind Griffin's instructions. On a night like this, you couldn't see more than a few feet past your own nose, and even if you could, you wouldn't care to look. Rain like this made you walk with your head down, shoulders hunched, indifferent to the world until you got to somewhere warm. At 11:45, Robin threw on a coat and stepped into the hallway. "Where are you going?" He froze. He'd thought Rami was asleep. "Forgot something in the stacks," he whispered. Rami cocked his head. "Again?" "I suppose it's our curse," Robin whispered, trying to keep his expression blank. "It's pouring. Go and get it tomorrow," Rami frowned. "What is it?" "My readings," Robin almost said. But that couldn't be right, because he'd purportedly been working on them all night. Just my diary. It'll keep me up if I leave it. I'm nervous about anyone seeing my notes." "What's in there? A love letter?" "No, it's just... it makes me nervous." Either he was a spectacular liar, or Rami was too sleepy to care. "Make sure I get up tomorrow," he said, yawning.
"I'm spending all night with Dryden, and I don't like it."
"Will do," Robin promised, and hastened out the door.
The punishing rainfall made the 10-minute walk up High Street feel like an eternity. Babel shone in the distance like a warm candle, each floor still fully lit, as if it were the middle of the afternoon, though hardly any silhouettes were visible through the windows. Babel's scholars worked around the clock, but most took their books home with them by 9 or 10, and anyone still there at midnight was not likely to leave the tower until morning. When he reached the green, he paused and peered around. He saw no one. Griffin's letter had been so vague. He didn't know if he should wait until he glimpsed one of the Hermes operatives, or if he should go ahead and follow his orders precisely.
Do not deviate from my instructions.
The bells rang for midnight. He hurried up to the entrance, mouth dry, breathless. When he reached the stone steps, two figures materialized from the darkness. Both black-clad youths whose faces he could not make out in the rain.
Go on, one of them whispered. Hurry.
Robin stepped up to the door. Robin Swift, he said, softly but clearly. The wards recognized his blood. The lock clicked. Robin pulled the door open and paused for the briefest moment on the doorstep, just long enough for the figures behind him to slink into the tower. He never saw their faces. They dashed up the staircase like wraiths. Quick and silent. Robin stood in the foyer, shivering as rain dripped down his forehead, watching the clock as the seconds ticked towards the 5-minute mark. It was all so easy. When the time came, Robin turned and strode out the door. He felt a slight bump at his waist, but otherwise perceived nothing. No whispers, no clinks of silver bars. The Hermes operatives were swallowed by the dark. In seconds, it was as if they had never been there at all. Robin turned and walked back toward Magpie Lane, shivering violently, dizzy with the sheer audacity of what he'd just done. He slept badly. He kept tossing in his bed in a nightmarish fugue, soaking his sheets with sweat, tortured by half-dreams, anxious extrapolations in which the police kicked down his door and dragged him off to jail, declaring they'd seen everything and knew everything. He did not fall properly asleep until the early morning, and by then he was so exhausted he missed the morning bells. He did not awake until the scout knocked at his door, asking if he'd like his floor swept that day.
Oh, yes, sorry. Just give me a moment and I'll be out.
He splashed water on his face, dressed, and dashed out the door. His cohort had arranged to meet in a study room on the 5th floor to compare their translations before class, and now he was terribly late.
There you are, said Rami when he arrived.
He, Letty, and Victoire were all seated around a square table.
I'm sorry I left without you, but I thought you'd gone already. I knocked twice, but you never answered.
It's all right. Robin took a seat. I didn't sleep well. Must have been the thunder, I think.
Are you feeling all right?
Victoire looked concerned.
You're sort of...
She waved a hand vaguely before her face.
Pale?
Just nightmares, he said. Happens, and sometimes. This excuse sounded stupid the moment it left his mouth, but Victoire gave his hand a sympathetic pat.
Of course.
Can we start?
Letty asked sharply.
We've just been dithering around with vocabulary because Rami wouldn't let us go on without you.
Robin hastily shuffled through his pages until he found last night's assigned Ovid.
Sorry, yes, of course.
He'd feared he would never sit through the entire meeting, but somehow the warm sunlight against the cool wood, the scratch of ink against parchment, and Letty's crisp, clear dictation pulled his exhausted mind into focus, made Latin, not his impending expulsion, seem like the most pressing order of the day. The study meeting turned out much livelier than expected. Robin, who was used to reading his translations out loud to Mr. Chester, who drolly corrected him as he went, was not anticipating such hearty debate over turns of phrase, punctuation, or how much repetition was too much. It quickly became apparent they had drastically different translation styles. Letty, who was a stickler for grammatical structures that adhered to the Latin as much as possible, seemed ready to forgive the most astoundingly awkward manipulations of prose, while Rami, her polar opposite, was always ready to abandon technical accuracy for rhetorical flourishes he insisted would better deliver the point. even when this meant insertion of completely novel clauses. Victoire seemed constantly frustrated with the limits of English.
It's so awkward. French would suit this better.
And Letty always vehemently agreed, which made Rami snort, at which point the topic of Ovid was abandoned for a repeat of the Napoleonic Wars.
Feeling better?
Rami asked Robin when they adjourned.
He was, actually. It felt good to sink into the refuge of a dead language, to fight a rhetorical war whose stakes could not really touch him. He was astonished by how ordinary the rest of the day felt, how calmly he could sit among his cohort as Professor Playfair lectured and pretend that Teitler was the foremost subject on his mind. In the light of day, the exploits of last night seemed a faraway dream. The tangible and solid consisted of Oxford, of coursework and professors, and freshly baked scones and clotted cream. Still, he could not erase the lurking dread that this was all a cruel joke, that the curtains would come down any minute on this charade. For how could there not be some consequence? Such an act of betrayal, of stealing from Babel itself, the institution to which he'd literally given his blood, should surely have made this life impossible. Anxiety hit him properly mid-afternoon. What had last night seemed like such a thrilling, righteous mission now seemed incredibly stupid. He couldn't focus on Latin. Professor Kraft had to snap her fingers in front of his eyes before he realized she'd asked him three times over to scan a line. He kept imagining horrible scenarios with vivid detail. How the constables would burst in, point, and yell, "There he is, the thief!" How his cohort would stare, stunned. How Professor Lovell, who was for some reason both prosecutor and judge, would coldly sentence Robin to the noose. He imagined the fireplace poker, coming down again and again, cold and methodical, snapping every single one of his bones. But the visions remained only that. No one came to arrest him. Their class proceeded slowly, blandly, uninterrupted. His terror faded. By the time Robin and his cohort reassembled in hall for supper, he found it astonishingly easy to pretend to himself that last night had never happened. And once they were seated with their food, cold potatoes and steaks so tough it took all their might to hack off chewable bits, laughing at Professor Kraft's irritated corrections of Rami's embellished translations, it indeed felt like only a distant memory. A new note awaited him under the windowsill when he returned home that night. He unfolded it with shaking hands. The message scrawled within was very brief, and this time Robin managed to decode it in his head. Await further contact. His disappointment confused him. Hadn't he spent the day wishing he'd never been ensnared in this nightmare? He could just imagine Griffin's mocking voice.
"What, did you want a pat on the back? A biscuit for a job well done?"
He now found himself hoping for more. But he had no way of knowing when he might hear from Griffin again. Griffin had warned Robin their contact would be sporadic, that entire terms might pass before he was in touch again. Robin would be summoned when he was needed, and no sooner. He found no note at his windowsill the next evening, or the evening after that. Days passed, and then weeks. "You're still a Babel student," Griffin had told him. "Act like one." It turned out this was very easy to do. As the memories of Griffin and Hermes receded into the back of his mind, into nightmares and the dark, his life at Oxford and at Babel rose to the forefront in glaring, dazzling colour. It stunned him how quickly he fell in love with the place and the people. He hadn't even noticed it happening. His first term had him spinning in place, dazed and exhausted. His classes and coursework formed a rote pattern of frenzied readings and late, bleary-eyed nights against which his cohort was his only source of joy and solace. The girls, bless them, quickly forgave Robin and Rami for their first impressions. Robin discovered he and Victoire shared the same unabashed love of literature of all kinds, from gothic horrors to romances, and they took great pleasure in swapping and discussing the latest batch of penny dreadfuls brought in from London. And Letty, once she'd been persuaded the boys were indeed not too stupid to be at Oxford, became a great deal more tolerable. She turned out to possess both an acerbic wit and a keen understanding of the British class structure by virtue of her upbringing, which made for infinitely amusing commentary when it wasn't aimed at either of them. Colin's the sort of bottom-feeding middle-class leech who likes to pretend he's got connections because his family knows a mathematics tutor in Cambridge, she would say after a visit to Magpie Lane. If he wants to be a solicitor, he could just get an apprenticeship at the Inns of Court. But he's here because he wants the prestige and connections. Only he's not half charming enough to acquire them. He's got the personality of a wet towel, damp, and he clings. At this point, she would do an impression of Colin's wide-eyed, over-solicitous greetings, while the rest of them roared with laughter. Rami, Victoire, and Letty, they became the colours of Robin's life, the only regular contact he had with the world outside his coursework. They needed each other because they had no one else. The older students at Babel were aggressively insular. They were too busy, too intimidatingly brilliant and impressive. 2 weeks into the term, Letty boldly asked a graduate fellow named Gabriel if she might join the French reading group, but was swiftly rejected with a particular disdain only the French could muster. Robin tried to befriend a Japanese third-year student named Ilsa Dejima.
Like Robin, Ilsa was known to the English not by her birth name, but by an adopted name, a combination of a chosen anglicised name, Ilsa, and the island from which she had come, Dejima,
who spoke with a faint Dutch accent. They crossed paths often on their ways in and out of Professor Chakravarti's office. But the few times he tried to say hello to her, she made a face as if he were mud on her boots. They tried to befriend the second-year cohort too, a group of five white boys who lived just across the way on Merton Street. But this went south immediately when one of them, Philip Wright, told Robin at a faculty dinner that the first-year cohort was largely international only because of departmental politics. The Board of Undergraduate Studies is always fighting over whether to prioritise European languages or other, more exotic languages. Chakravarti and Lovell have been making a stink about diversifying the student body for years. They didn't like that my cohort are all classicists. I assume they were overcorrecting with you. Robin tried to be polite. I'm not sure why that's such a bad thing. Well, it's not a bad thing per se, but it does mean spots taken away from equally qualified candidates who pass the entrance exams. I didn't take any entrance exams, said Robin. Precisely, Philip sniffed, and did not say another word to Robin for the entire evening. So it was Rami, Letty, and Victoire who became such constant interlocutors that Robin started seeing Oxford through their eyes. Rami would adore that purple scarf hanging in the window of Eden Ravenscroft. Letty would laugh herself silly at the puppy-eyed young man sitting outside Queen's Lane Coffee House with a book of sonnets. Victoire would be so excited that a new batch of scones had just been put out at Vault and Garden. But because she would be stuck in her French tutorial until noon, Robin absolutely had to buy one, wrap it up in his pocket, and save it for her for when class was let out. Even his course readings became more exciting when he began seeing them as source material for cutting observations, complaining or humorous, to be shared later with the group. They were not without their rifts. They argued endlessly, the way bright young people with well-fed egos and too many opinions do. Robin and Victoire had a long-running debate over the superiority of English versus French literature, wherein both were oddly, fiercely loyal to their adopted countries. Victoire insisted that England's best theorists could not hold a candle to Voltaire or Diderot, and Robin would have given her the benefit of the doubt if only she didn't keep scoffing at the translations he took out from the Bodleian on the grounds that they're nothing compared to the original. You might as well not read it at all. Victoire and Letty, though normally quite close, seemed to always get snippy on issues of money and whether Letty truly counted as poor as she claimed to be just because her father had cut her off.
The boys stayed out of this one. Privately, Rami thought Letty had a fair point that, as a woman, she was entitled to inherit none of the Price estate to begin with. Robin thought it was a bit rich for her to call herself impoverished, when they were all receiving stipends sizable enough that they could dine out whenever they felt like it.
And Letty and Rami bickered most of all. Largely over Rami's claim that Letty had never stepped foot in the colonies and therefore shouldn't opine on the supposed benefits of the British presence in India. "I do know a thing or two about India," Letty would insist. "I've read all sorts of essays. I've read Hamilton's translation of the letters of a Hindu Raja." "Oh yes?" Rami would ask. "The one where India is a lovely Hindu nation overrun by tyrannical Muslim invaders? That one?" At which point, Letty would always get defensive, sullen and irritable, until the next day. But this was not entirely her fault. Rami seemed particularly determined to provoke her, to dismantle her every assertion. Proud, proper Letty, with her stiff upper lip, represented everything Rami disdained about the English. And Robin suspected Rami would not be satisfied until he got Letty to declare treason against her own country. Still, their fights could not really pull them apart. Rather, these arguments only drew them closer together, sharpened their edges, and defined the ways they fitted differently into the puzzle of their cohort. They spent all their time together. On weekends, they sat at a corner table outside the Vaults and Garden Café, interrogating Letty on the oddities of English, of which only she was a native speaker. "What does corned mean?" Robin would demand. "What is corned beef? What are you all doing to your beef?"
Robin, Victoire, and Rami were all very disappointed to learn that corned beef had nothing to do with corn, but with the size of rock salt crystals used to cure said beef.
"And what is a welcher?"
"A swindler, a grifter,"
Victoire would ask, looking up from her latest penny cereal. "Letitia, please, what in God's name is a jigger-dubber?"
"Thief's slang for a jailer. Jigger, meaning door, and dubber, meaning closer."
When Rami complained that the food in the hall was so bad that he was visibly dropping weight, this was true. The UNIF kitchens, when they weren't serving the same rotation of tough boiled meat, unsalted roast vegetables, and indistinguishable pottages, put out inexplicable and inedible dishes with names like India pickle, turtle dressed the West India way, and something called China chillo, very little of which was halal. They stole into the kitchen and cobbled a dish out of chickpeas, potatoes, and an assortment of spices Rami had scrounged together from Oxford's markets. The result was a lumpy scarlet stew so spicy that they all felt like they'd been punched in the nose. Rami refused to accept defeat. Instead, he argued, this was further proof of his grand thesis that there was something fundamentally wrong with the British. Since if they'd been able to get their hands on real turmeric and mustard seeds, then the dish would have tasted much better. "There are Indian restaurants in London," Letty objected. "You can get curries with rice in Piccadilly."
"Only if you want bland mash," Rami scoffed. "Finish your chickpeas."
Letty, sniffling miserably, refused to take another bite. Robin and Victoire stoically kept shoveling spoonfuls into their mouths. Rami told them they were all cowards. In Calcutta, he claimed, infants could eat ghost peppers without batting an eye. But even he had trouble finishing the fiery red mass on his plate. Robin didn't realize what he had, what he'd been searching for and had finally obtained, until one night, halfway through the term, when they were all in Victoire's rooms. Hers were improbably the largest of any of their quarters, because none of the other boarders wanted to share with her, which meant not only did she have a bedroom all to herself, but also the bathroom and the spacious sitting room where they'd taken to congregating to finish their coursework after the Bodleian closed at 9. That night, they were playing cards, not studying, because Professor Kraft was in London for a conference, which meant they had the evening off. But the cards were soon forgotten, because an intense stench of ripe pears suddenly pervaded the room, and none of them could figure out what it was, because they hadn't been eating pears, and because Victoire swore she didn't have any stashed away in her room. Then Victoire was rolling on the ground, both laughing and shrieking, because Letty kept screaming, "Where is the pear? Where is it, Victoire? Where is the pear?" Rami made a joke about the Spanish Inquisition, so Letty, playing along, ordered Victoire to turn out all her coat pockets to prove none of them concealed the core. Victoire obeyed, but turned up nothing, which sent them into further shrieks of hysterics. And Robin sat at the table, watching them, smiling as he waited for the card game to resume until he realized that it wouldn't because they were all laughing too much, and besides, Rami's cards were splayed across the floor face up, so continuing was pointless. Then he blinked, because he just registered what this most mundane and extraordinary moment meant. That in the space of several weeks, they had become what he'd never found in Hampstead, what he thought he'd never have again after Canton, a circle of people he loved so fiercely, his chest hurt when he thought about them. A family. He felt a crush of guilt then for loving them and Oxford as much as he did. He adored it here. He really did. For all the daily slights he suffered, walking through campus delighted him. He simply could not maintain, as Griffin did, an attitude of constant suspicion or rebellion. He could not acquire Griffin's hatred of this place. Yet, didn't he have a right to be happy? He had never felt such warmth in his chest until now. Had never looked forward to getting up in the morning as he did now. Babel, his friends, and Oxford, they had unlocked a part of him. A place of sunshine and belonging that he never thought he'd feel again. The world felt less dark. He was a child starved of affection, which he now had in abundance. And was it so wrong for him to cling to what he had? He was not ready to commit fully to Hermes. But by God, he would have killed for any of his cohort. Later, it would amaze Robin that it never seriously crossed his mind to tell any of them about the Hermes Society. After all, by the end of Michaelmas term, he had come to trust them with his life. He had no doubt that if he fell into the frozen Isis, any one of them would have dived in to save him. Yet Griffin and the Hermes Society belonged to bad dreams and shadows. His cohort was sun and warmth and laughter, and he could not imagine bringing those worlds together. Only once was he ever tempted to say something. At lunch one day, Rami and Letty were arguing, once again, over the British presence in India. Rami regarded the occupation of Bengal as an ongoing travesty. Letty thought the British victory at Plassey was more than fair retaliation for what she considered the horrific treatment of hostages by Siraj ud Daula, and that the British need never have intervened if the Mughals had not been such terrible rulers. "And it's not as if you have had it all so bad," said Letty. "There are plenty of Indians in the civil administration, as long as they're qualified." "Yes, where qualified means an elite class that speaks English and acts like toadies to the British," said Rami. "We're not being ruled, we're being misruled. What's happening to my country is nothing short of robbery. It's not open trade, it's financial bleeding, it's looting and sacking. We've never needed their help, and they've only constructed that narrative out of a misplaced sense of superiority." "If you think that, then what are you doing in England?" Letty challenged. Rami looked at her as if she were crazy. "Learning, woman." "Ah, to acquire the weapons to bring down the empire," she scoffed. "You're going to take some silver bars home and start a revolution, are you? Shall we march into Babel and declare your intentions?" For once, Rami did not have a quick riposte. "It's not as simple as that," he said after a pause. "Oh, really?" Letty had found the spot where it hurt. Now she was like a dog with a bone and she wouldn't let go. "Because it seems to me that the fact that you're here enjoying an English education is precisely what makes the English superior. Unless there's a better language institute in Calcutta." "There's plenty of brilliant madrasas in India," Rami snapped. "What makes the English superior is guns. Guns and the willingness to use them on innocent people. So, you're here to ship silver back to those mutinying sepoys, are you?"
"Perhaps he should," Robin almost said. "Perhaps that's precisely what the world needs." But he stopped himself before he opened his mouth. Not because he was afraid of breaking Griffin's confidence, but because he could not bear how this confession would shatter the life they'd built for themselves. And because he himself could not resolve the contradiction of his willingness to thrive at Babel
even as it became clearer, day by day, how obviously unjust were the foundations of its fortunes. The only way he could justify his happiness here, to keep dancing on the edges of two worlds, was to continue awaiting Griffin's correspondence at night. A hidden, silent rebellion whose main purpose was to assuage his guilt over the fact that all this gold and glitter had to come at a cost. Chapter 8. We then used to consider it not the least vulgar for a parcel of lads who had been whipped 3 months previous, and were not allowed more than 3 glasses of port at home, to sit down to pineapples and ices at each other's rooms and fuddle themselves with champagne and claret. William Makepeace Thackeray, The Book of Snobs. In the last weeks of November, Robin assisted in 3 more thefts for the herd.